The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Myers.
10 minutes after 7. Suzanne Segerman joins me. She has been featured in the New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, BBC, The Beeb, ABC News 2. And we're going to be talking about real estate with her, but I wanted to talk to her about her nonprofit too, because this intrigues me. She co-founded Games for Change, award-winning nonprofit of video games for social good. That is interesting. Suzanne, how are you doing this morning? Welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Oh, thanks so much, Bill. Happy New Year. Okay. Thanks for having me.
Indeed. Happy New Year, indeed. We could all use a little happier New Year, as far as I'm concerned, all right? Games for Change, though. You know, normally when we think about video games, it's about, okay, what is the worst race to the bottom and most mayhem and social destruction we can certainly come up with, okay? So I'm kind of curious, what about Games for Change? What did you do with that? I'm curious about that.
Well, you know, I wasn't a gamer. I didn't know much about it, but I played this game that kind of brought me into a new country where you can make decisions about who we want to be president and who you want to be in your cabinet. And It really changed my mind about what games could be possible. And so I started promoting this idea of let's make new kinds of games, games about poverty alleviation or the environment or, creating good families, like lots of different ways that people can go about making games. And so there's now this kind of new category of games called Games for Social Good. Huh. And they're about real world things, kind of like documentaries are for in the film world.
Yeah. Do you actually do people download them and buy them? Does it work that way? I know that I always hear about stuff like Call of Duty. I'm not much of a gamer myself, you know, truth be told, but just curious how that works.
Yeah, they're in every category. You can have little handheld games on your phone. You can play a serious game on a platform. There's all sorts of different opportunities now in these new kinds of games. And the serious game companies are taking them seriously, too. Just like when you get on Netflix and you have a choice to watch a documentary or you choose, you know, some shoot 'em up, you can do the same with games.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I have to ask you, what was it like being a person at a TED Talk? Because, you know, TED Talk almost seems like, man, you have arrived. If you get invited to do a TED Talk and then your videos get shared, you know, 500 million times, you know, that sort of thing. What was that like? And what did you talk about on that?
Well, I talked about the games. A lot of people didn't know that games are just a young medium. They're kind of like a medium about to grow up, just like film was back in the 1920s or something like that. And so it was, of course, very terrifying, but it was also a lot of fun to talk about something I really felt strongly about.
Did they applaud when you were done?
They did.
Okay, so you weren't like anybody out there saying, hey, it's time to please clap, right? You didn't have to say that, right? Okay.
No, I didn't. There might have been signs, but I didn't see them, luckily.
Yeah, that's an embarrassing TED Talk when you have to ask them to clap, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Suzanne, I wanted to take you to your current experience, and this is an article that you ended up sharing recently, and it has to do with how to make money with rental property. And in your particular case, though, it didn't work out so well, and so you wanted to share some of the pitfalls, what you got to watch out for. And you're thinking about, hey, I'm going to make a bunch of bucks, I'm going to have a short-term rental maybe, or else I'm going to rent some houses or apartments I have. What happened with you? And by the way, where did you share that, if you don't mind? Where did you put that?
No problem. You know, we had a place in New York City we'd been renting for a while, and it was terrific. Mm-hmm. And then one time, one bad guy moved in, and he basically tore down the entire interior of the loft. It was absolutely insane. When we arrived at night, I could see like pieces of my baby daughter's bedroom on the street, you know, waiting for pickup. It was just terrifying. And we came in to say, you know, what's going on? This is an emergency. You can't do this without Department of Buildings permit and permission from me, by the way.
Yeah, and, yeah, you because, know, you know, you being the pesky property owner, right?
Yeah,
little
yeah,
minor
hello.
Things like that, right?
Right, yeah. And then he punched my architect in the face and broke both her hands. So it was really a bad situation. Yeah, and he has victims all over the world. I wrote about it. I call them the monster tenant, and it's in New York Magazine. And so I got so much response from that. A lot of landlords were saying, you know, how do I stop that from happening to me? And so I ended up putting together a little list of recommendations for folks, because it really can be a great way to make money, but it's also a huge risk, and you have to know what you're getting into.
Now, did you make money with this apartment or with your flat? Was it an Airbnb or a longer-term rental?
It was a regular long-term rental. Okay. We had normal tenants in there, and everything went well for, you know, 10 years, and then this one bad guy.
It seemed to me that one of the biggest challenges that I've seen, and we've had a lot of people that I've known in Oregon that you know, when the COVID situation came around, ended up just going down in flames financially because you were told by government, well, hey, you know, you can't kick people out and nor can you charge them necessarily. And did that affect you, or is that what brought the monster into your existence, or was there something else that did that?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I think the hard part for us was in the middle of the pandemic, they did have an eviction moratorium in New York City, so you couldn't kick anyone out. And I think he knew this and took advantage of that situation, knowing if I can get myself in there, and he even tried to get in early, too. If I can get myself into that place, she can't kick me out. And that's essentially what he did. Luckily, we could and did kick him out, but it took a while, and he had to flee because the police were after him for having punched my architect. So in some weird way, you know, our poor architect, who's now fine, thank God, you know.
By the way, is the monster in jail for the punching and the breaking and the assault and things like that? Or is that not punished any longer in New York?
Oh, yeah. No, he's on the loose. I got to tell you, the cops were not. They kept saying, telling us, go to housing court. And housing court had 2 years backlog and something like 50,000 cases. So, you know, we had to do something else. And so we got very lucky and we put up a ring cam, a security cam, and sort of watched him, and then, you know, told the cops when he was home. And that, I think, scared him because he knew the cops could come. And I said, told the cops, you break that door down. I don't care about that door.
Wow.
And then he fled on his own. So, but he flees, you know, he's done this to many victims. I found during the course of my research and in the article.
So you weren't the only person that he ended up destroying the homes of. He did this multiple times, but yet there were many people that just well-meaning landlords like yourself, right? So you're piecing together, you did a little detective work on this. Suzanne Segerman with me once again, and I'm going to link to her site and everything else you can learn more about this. So you had the monster, and then you are looking out, and a lot of other people have been victimized by the monster too. And what are some of your suggestions to help not be victimized by a rental monster like what you had?
Well, the first thing is, I always thought the broker was the one who was going to do all the vetting and, you know, pass the person along. And that isn't true at all. The broker basically just gives you the information they give to them. So you have to check everything that a broker passes to you. You have to do a background check yourself. You have to do a credit report yourself. You know, not only that, you want to call up the educational institutions they say they went to school at, call up their employment and verify it. Hmm. You have to do all the legwork. Do not expect that broker for their commission to get to do that for you. You have to do it yourself.
So even if they do a test or a background check, you do your own to your specifications, right?
Yep.
Okay.
You've got to check your local laws, of course, because some laws are not, they don't like that, but you do everything yourself as much as possible and try to find other people that know that person. So if they say, hey, I used to work for Hershey's Chocolate or wherever, you know, see if you could find someone who worked at the same company or some connection to them and sort of, you know, find somebody who knows them. Do whatever you can. You're basically getting into a relationship with this person. So you really want to know as much as you can.
I do like, Suzanne, how you talked about going online and then doing doing a word search for not only the name, but also include housing court, arrest, conviction, things like that, right? Those sort of things.
Really, absolutely. You know, some laws will not, New York City won't let you use that information. you know, before you let somebody into your home. So you have to find other ways to do to get information on people.
Hmm. Now, has the or are the laws really totally against the landlord these days? Is it just my impression of that or the wrong impression? How do you think about that? Because it seems to me that I knew so many people that, like I said, practically lost money on their rentals for a number of years because of what happened, not just COVID, but with other things, you know, ban the box. You can't check and see if someone was a convicted felon, you know, all those kind of things. That's in Oregon, by the way, I think is, you know, what you can't do, you know, for that. And so it's like you can't even know your tenant in some cases. What do you think?
Well, I think it's different in each locale. You know, one city is going to be very different from the other city, and different states have different laws. So you really have to get to know your own laws. In New York, it's very pro-tenant. But, you know, there are a lot of bad landlords out there, too.
Oh, yeah. So, I have no doubt. You know, I have no doubt.
New York has a lot of bad landlords.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just kind of curious. When, you know, you have property in New York, and naturally it's rent control, right? You're in a rent control kind of situation there. Am I correct?
No, God, not at all. This is very, very, you know, expensive real estate on a very fancy block.
Not when I bought it.
When I bought it, it was, you know, there were crack vials on the stoop and dealers around the corner. It was a very dangerous neighborhood. But now New York has become so, you know, cleaned up and safe. And my block is now one of the fanciest blocks in New
York. Well, the reason I asked about the rent control is that rent control came to Oregon in our legislature. And it came in the response with zooming housing rates and rental rates. And I understand that because there's been a lot of inflationary pushes. There's been strain on the housing market. And yet what I've noticed is that rent control almost seems to make sure that if you are a landlord, the first thing you will do is raise your rent the maximum you're allowed, because you never know if that's going to change in the future. Could you comment on that? Has that ever happened? Do you know?
You know, I know that rent control is a really complex.
It is. I know.
In New York, I know a lot. It hasn't worked in New York in a lot of ways. I think that it's a really good idea in principle, and I think you have to be very, very careful about how you institute it. But I know a lot of wealthy people are, you know, on top of these rent control places in New York.
Yeah.
So they find ways to get around it. So, you know, I think it's all about the implementation, you know, how well they actually put it together and enforce it.
All right. Hey, back to some of your checklists, though, on the way to protect yourself from the monster. By the way, how much did it cost for you to refurbish your place with the monster who rented
it? Well, our insurance, I luckily got insurance 2 years before this guy moved in. I don't know how I did it, but it was something called tenants insurance.
Oh.
And I was very lucky to have that in place. So we could afford to put back two of the four bedrooms. So it went from a four bedroom to a two bedroom. And they gave us $100,000, the insurance.
Wow.
And that, you know, he took down four walls of bookshelves, five closets, you know, two bedrooms. I mean, he just ripped everything out.
And you couldn't do anything. You couldn't kick him out. Just no way. Not allowed to. Wow.
No. I mean, I could have called Department of Buildings and said he's doing work, quote unquote work, without a permit, and they would have come and thrown him out, and they would have fined me, you know. So I made a decision to go a different direction. So I could have gotten him out immediately. But
so when it comes to the bad tenants, you have to do your diligence prior, because once they're there, it's very difficult. All right. And it also means meeting in person, not just letting the broker deal with it, right?
Absolutely. Try to do as much as you can and meet them face to face. You know, bring a friend along, bring a broker, somebody, but, you know, recognize that you're going to be in relationship with this person for a while, and you need to know who they are and trust your instincts too.
I thought that one of the most interesting things you have on this checklist is, number 9 and number 10, well, 8, 9, and 10, really. First off, if you have anything personal in these rentals, get them out, right? You don't want anything up there at all.
Or lock them up,
Okay.
Absolutely.
And also, and I guess if this is a more expensive rental, include a maid service, so this way they're required to let them in, and you get to know what's going on, if there's anything hinky, right?
Yeah.
That kind of thing?
Yeah, this was furnished. I mean, it is furnished now. It's easier to get the maid service in if it's furnished. But if it's not, you could still ask for it. But the property manager check-in, number 10, that one is a really great thing to do, because what you do is basically tell them, look, we're taking care of you. We're going to make sure that everything works in the apartment. We care that much about you. Meanwhile, we're also going to get in there and make sure you're not bringing cockroaches in and you're not, you know, tearing something down. Or
yeah, and you don't have 25 people living in two rooms, right?
Right.
That kind of thing. That's actually good. My mother lives in an apartment complex like that. Every quarter they come in there, they do an inspection. And ostensibly, yeah, it's to make sure that everything's working okay. But it also, but it protects both sides, really, when it comes right down
to it. Absolutely.
You know, making sure that, I mean, we all know what is really going on with that. Where can people read this article of yours, by the way, Suzanne?
So it's in New York Magazine, so nymag.com. And you can also follow my, I'm doing updates and things on my social media. So it's Suzanne Segerman on Instagram or Facebook.
SuzanneSegerman.com too. I'll put all that information up there for you. Are you at the point now where you just can't, you don't want to do any more rentals at this point, or have you recovered, or is there still some PTSD that comes from this?
No, I actually did have PTSD. Thank you for asking that. Nobody's asked that before, and I really did. I had agoraphobia for about 6 months afterwards. But no, we have a fantastic tenant in there now, and we ended up, you know, strange quirk of fate. I decided we had to get legal fees paid. We didn't have the money for that. So we ended up furnishing it, which is much higher rent. And so we actually are doing quite well now that's a furnished apartment. So in the end, he helped us. Just from lots of good decisions, I turned it around. So it was
It sounds like you're a little blessed in that end part about it. Hey, one thing before we take off, what about the squatter issue? Now, I know every state could be different. In your particular place, is there a certain amount of time where if someone squats in your apartment that then you have to hire, you know, the entire world to get them out, or are they getting tougher on those kind of things now? We've all heard horror stories.
You know, I know. I've heard those, too. I'm sure there's a squatter law in New York. I don't know anything about it. I think it would be very hard to do. You could just probably change the locks on our place. But I've heard about it happening in Queens and other places where people just move in and they can't get them out. It's very frightening to me. But yeah, I think across the country there, you know, people can move into places and then claim them as their own after a while. In some ways, this guy that moved into our place, the monster tenant, had planned to do something similar because he had mentioned the movie Pacific Heights, which is a movie about somebody doing just that. Before he moved in, he told me about Pacific Heights. So he had some crazy vision of what he wanted to do.
Yeah, I vaguely recall that. It was like not a Billy Crystal. Who was the, was he the?
It was Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, yeah. That's right,
tenant,
Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That's a movie I haven't thought of for a long time, and I hope to never have to think about it, given how creepy that was.
I know, and I had never heard of it. I didn't even think to look it up before he moved in. I was like, aha, funny, whatever that movie is, moving on. And it turned out he was playing out the narrative from that movie. Absolutely insane.
That's just wild. You can read up more, SuzanneSegerman.com, and the other information that I'll put up on KMED.com. Suzanne, I'm glad you got over that here. And just a cautionary tale if you want to make some money with your rental this year, and we'll put that all up, okay? Thank you so much. Good meeting you. Okay.
Thanks so much, Bill. Have a great week.
You too now. It is 727 KMED 99.3 KBXG. You're waking up with the Bill Myers Show. Really appreciate that.
At 770-KMED.
Dangerous time because it is the first conspiracy theory open phone time of the year. 770-5633. Given my conversation with Suzanne Segerman, anybody else have some tenant horror stories? Now, I know you'll see it on both sides of the aisle, right? She had the monster did about $100,000 damage to her New York apartment. Yikes. And it was pretty much a luxury place, though. But, man, just amazing story about that. I also see, though, the other side of it. There is the story that was in the Rogue Valley Times, I believe it was, the other day, about the folks, the low-income folks that are living in a, you know, mobile home park in the Talent area that are concerned because the rents have just gone up and up and up for a number of years now. And their space rent, in many cases, close to, if I recall correctly, about $750, that kind of thing. And is that necessarily out of line with the market rate? Probably not. But Oregon is a rent control state now. And I know that she couldn't really, you know, speak to that. She wasn't dealing with a rent control apartment, Suzanne, you know, going back to her. But I can't help but think that if you're in a rent control place like Oregon now, and you're told that you can rent, or that you could raise the rent, 9, 10%, whatever the rate might be. I think we're at 9 or 10% that you're permitted, you know, this time around, a maximum each year. That given that the state has already told you that we're going to control what you can do with that, wouldn't you, if you're a landlord, have a great incentive to automatically raise the rent each year when the state is telling you, hey, this is the max you can do it? Because then, if the state is saying that that's the max that you can do it, they can also change that and ratchet it down and saying, well, I'm sorry, you can only raise it 1%. I mean, once you've already gone down that road of rent control, isn't that the ultimate response? Just a natural incentive to raise the rent when you're told that the state's going to limit what you can raise. I'm just talking about, you know, how the, well, you know, what this means in the real world. And then in many ways, I think it's better off when there is no limitation whatsoever, because then if you're a landlord, you don't have the pressure to think that, well, I'm not actually being screwed too badly right now with the property taxes, et cetera, but, you know, if the property taxes go up next year, I can pass that along. And then you don't worry about it. But in a rent control situation, aren't you going to automatically assume the worst about what Oregon will do? Why don't you just raise that issue? So I'm sympathetic on both sides of the rental coin. I haven't rented for a lot of years, but I know a lot of people who do. 770-5633. We could talk about that. It doesn't have to be about that. But anything else on your mind, too? Let me go to Matt. Matt, Happy New Year. Good to hear from you. What's up?
Happy New Year, Bill. I had two quick things. One, I hate the term radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
The terrorism thing is near and dear to my heart. And the first thing I started hearing out of reporters' mouths, or actors, as you guys pointed out earlier, is that, oh, this guy Jabbar was radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
Because
they're acting as if it was passive, right?
Yeah, well, radicalized basically to me sounds like, oh, you know, he's a good guy. It's like, you know, whenever you have a serial killer and the neighbors say, oh, he was a perfectly fine guy.
Yeah, well, you're radicalized like you caught a cold, in other words, right?
Yeah, it's somebody else's fault.
Uh-huh.
That's my problem with it. It's like, oh, he was fine, but oh, he got radicalized. So they're blaming somebody else for what this guy did. He's a despicable human being, and the world's better off without him. By the way, I'm looking at headlines, and right at the top here, they're saying that the guy with the cyber truck, that they served together on the same military base.
Really?
It says Las Vegas cyber truck bombers served at the same U.S. military bases in New Orleans.
Yeah, that just came out, and that sounds like a bit of a very convenient connection, wouldn't you say?
Well, the second headline is both trucks rented using the same Turo app.
Mm-hmm.
So my second thing is, when the financial crisis hit and real estate got cheap, I was actually looking at duplexes to, you know, be a landlord. I thought, oh, you know, diversify a little bit. And I went into a place. The price was right, but there was this giant, like, disco ball hanging there. There were all these fairies and quartz things hanging from the walls with black light paintings of fairies and Dungeons and Dragons. And I stood there and I looked around and I said to myself, would I let this guy come to my house for dinner?
And the answer is no, you would not let him come to your house for dinner, right?
And I decided I never want to be a landlord, all because of that. I just thought, you know what? I know the people I'm going to rent to are not going to be like me. They're not going to pay their rent all the time. They're going to be calling me in the middle of the night when the toilet doesn't flush. And I thought, why would I want to get myself involved in any of this?
Yeah. It seems to be a harsh deal to be a landlord these days. Now, I know I'll get people that'll talk about their lousy landlord, and I have no doubt that they exist. But overall, I think the legal realm is, or at least the state of Oregon, and the state of Oregon, the thumb's a little bit more on the renter's side. At least it looks that way. Would that be a fair assessment, the way it's looking these days?
It is. And I talked to a friend of mine who has, I think, 7 or 8 rentals, and has for 25, 30 years.
And if you cannot kick out a dirtbag, there's a problem in our world. And I hear from landlords that say that it's next to impossible to kick out the dirtbag. It takes months in many cases.
He said, from his point of view, he said, I charge less rent when I have great tenants. And he says, the only time I raise rent is I got to replace the roof. They've been in there 15, 20 years. The roof has to be replaced. He said, so I always just left the rent where it was because, you know, I'm fine. And so you work that out. But I asked him what was going to happen when the rent control thing passed in Oregon. He told me flat out, he goes, I'm just going to have to raise them every other year.
But you see, that's what I thought. That's what I thought was going to happen. I'm looking at that story in the Rogue Valley Times, in which the people in the mobile home park, the senior citizens and people of limited means there, they're all talking about that the rates have gone up every year. And to me, when you have the state already telling you that we are going to limit your ability to raise it, we will permit you to raise it this year, you well know that the landlord's going to look at this as, hey, wait a minute, maybe next year they say I can only raise 1%. And I know that the property taxes are going up 3 or 4%, you know, those kind of things. And I can't make it pencil that way, or you're going to need a roof or all these other things, right? So doesn't rent control, in essence, hurt it more than it helps overall?
Well, look at Argentina. When Milei got in there, that's one of the things he got rid of was rent control. And the rents did go up. But you know what happened? They settled back down again. He's only been in there a year. I mean, the guy he's done every free market thing you can think of doing.
Right.
And so the rents went up and people were freaking out. But then what happened is a bunch more housing things were built because people said, well, now I want to invest in real estate because I'm not going to be regulated like I was before. It's going to be worth my money to invest. And when all the other housing came onto the market, the rent came down.
Yeah, well, what's happening in Oregon is that they're trying to do the opposite. They're going to say, oh, we don't have any affordable housing, so we're going to have lots of regulation on this. But why isn't the affordable housing coming up? Because, well, you limit what we can charge. They're going to define what is affordable, not what can actually be built. That's all.
What was Kamala Harris's solution for inflation? It was to fix prices.
Yeah.
This is what the left always does. They never say to themselves, why are prices high? It's because of scarcity. You've said this 1,000 times on the air over the years I've been listening. If it's scarce, it's expensive. So let's make it plentiful.
There you go. Thank you very much. Good hearing from you. Happy New Year. 7:38. We'll catch up on the rest of the news. Anything else on your mind? It is open phones on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. You can take it anywhere you want. This is the Bill Meyer Show.
Changing weather norms means changes to water quality. Be sure your drinking water is safe. The highs and lows of water levels, increasing cases of contamination, and land use changes can all impact your water.
Hi, I'm Matt Stone with Stone Heating and Air, and I'm on KMED.
7:42, it is open phones on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Dangerous time. Always gets me a little scared when we do those sort of things. We'll have a Diner 62 quiz coming up probably in the next few minutes, if not next hour. Sometime between now, and when Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins end up coming on. I'm also going to be talking with Cynthia Hughes, who is the founder and director of the Patriot Freedom Project, because we're getting into the fourth year anniversary of the January 6 riots and people still in jail. And we're going to be talking a bit about, you know, what happens legally with these people. We'll have that coming up a little bit after 8 o'clock this morning. All right. So we had the Ducks lose yesterday. I'm not surprised. It's Ohio State. Oh, well. You know, fortunately, I don't... I'm not into the football games to the point. I'll watch the Super Bowl. That's about it. But... you know, it's just not me. Just not me. If you're into it, God bless you. But you're probably depressed this morning. I can't help you. You know, those sort of things. But I had a wonderful time off, by the way. So people were wondering what did I do on my time off? Well, there was one day, the day after Christmas, that the storms were just knocking things off the air. So I was a little busy that day, all day. But we finally got things working again. And then the rest of it was very quiet and... you know, gosh, it was, you know, we had some friends over for kind of a pre-New Year's Eve celebration on Saturday. That was a lot of fun. A lot of great people came over. We had mimosas in the morning, you know, that kind of thing. So that was a lot of fun. And we had that. But other than that, it was like Linda and I, we sat around, we watched some movies. I played around in the garage on my workbench, my electronic workbench a lot. And I'm working on tube gear and, you know, like a tube amplifier. I still have the old tube oscillators from the old KMED AM 1440 and the KCMD, no, not KCMD, KCMX, the old KCMX AM 880. You know, when those AM sites were shut down a couple of years ago, that, you know, these were all abandoned in place, these old transmitters, and so I grabbed these parts from it. And so I have them working. They both work now. And I could have little low-power AM broadcasting on 880 and 1440 if I wanted to. So if the world goes to hell, I'll put up a big antenna, and then we'll communicate on AM broadcast. Illegally, of course, but, you know, if everything has gone to hell, who's going to come get me, right? So that's kind of the way I look at it. So I was having fun with that. And, you know, wiring things and watching capacitors smoke and blow up and as part of the experimenting process. But that's the way that went. But it was great. And Linda got us a Yahtzee game. I hadn't played Yahtzee. I've never been much of a game player. But there was just something that she said, I got us a Yahtzee game. And I haven't played Yahtzee in probably 10, 15 years, right? And so we played a lot of Yahtzee, or I should say, I was there rolling the dice. Linda was actually winning the Yahtzee game, and so she was kicking my butt through most of the holiday. But we just had a great time. Loved it. And wonderful meals, and went to Cartwright's and got nice steakies and things like that. It's just, life was good. It was very relaxing, so we enjoyed that. So that's what I did. Nothing important, which to me is like almost the best vacation that one can have, doing nothing important. If it's, you know, sometimes you can go on vacation, like when we went to France a number of years ago. That's not a relaxing vacation, but that was an adventure vacation. This was a relaxing vacation. You know, you get to sleep until 7 or 8. I never get to do that normal times. It was beautiful. So that's what I did. What about you, huh? I noticed that Garth and Rosemary, they were sharing a post about that. They ended up taking a cruise out to Hawaii. Boy, it's a nice time of year to head out there and do that, Garth and Rose. But they had a good time. Good to see Rose doing okay also. 747. This is an article I saw in the Rogue Valley Times. It just kind of cracked me up. How would you approach this one? What to do when no one can pronounce your child's name correctly? Oh, my goodness. Here we have a first world problem, apparently. And this was written by Amy Bazzari from the Chicago Tribune. Navigating the world as the parent of a child with a unique or difficult to pronounce name can be a constant source of frustration. When I named my daughter Kiara, I never considered that people would struggle with its pronunciation. Her name, which means light or clear in Italian, and it is deeply rooted in our family's heritage, is a super common name in Italy and ranked number 15 among baby girl names in Italy in 2023. But as Kiara began her school journey, we quickly realized that few native English speakers could pronounce her name correctly. Name pronunciation has been a hot topic lately, especially as Vice President Kamala Harris ran for president. The correct pronunciation of Kamala, which means lotus flower in Sanskrit, is Kamala, as the emphasis on the first syllable, sounding like Kamala. In a 2016 video during her Senate campaign, Harris even had a cast of kids explain what other pronunciations of her name weren't correct. But despite her best efforts, Harris's name continued to be mispronounced by many, sometimes even deliberately. Oh no. What are you going to do? Then they had some Irving Park kids they're talking about in Chicago, because we're supposed to be, you know, shocked and outraged about this. CPS students, Sheet Tlali, it's spelled X-I-T-L-A-L-I, Hernandez, and Lakia Williams, who both attended Carl Schurz High School in Irving Park, have encountered similar frustrations when it comes to people pronouncing or rather mispronouncing their names. My mom wanted me to have a unique name, so she named me Zictlali, an Aztec name that means Princess of the Stars, Hernandez said, which I guess is better than being named after cutting the hearts out of the princesses as an Aztec, but I digress because, you know, once again, we're supposed to respect all cultures. As someone who grew up with the last name of Prozac, that's my legal last name, it's been that way forever. You know, I've been putting up with this for years. It's like, so what? So what? Is this a big deal? I guess the main thing is that maybe if you don't want the kids to be laughed at and made fun of, think about how people will try to pronounce it. Now, let's look at this Kiara. Now, it looks like Chia. So just call her Chia Pet. How about you? It's called Chia, right? Chia Pet. All right. And to me, this is a problem in the, a solution in search of a problem, I guess. But the main thing is what to do when no one can pronounce your child's name correctly. Okay, well, first off, don't open up the medicine cabinet and name your child after what you're reading on the bottles. Okay, that's what I would say. I don't know if you have a take on that or not, but there you go. But once again, it's coming out of liberal Chicago. What can we expect?
Rule number one, if you're looking to sell a
home, then adults under 50, schedule your appointment today at VaxAssist.com.
Sponsored by Pfizer.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Wonder if anybody ever named their kid pneumococcal. Yeah, this is my son, pneumococcal. Yeah, he's catching, man. It's 7:52. Let me talk with Brad. Hey, Brad, how you doing this morning? Happy New Year. Good to hear from you.
Hey, buddy. It's always good listening to your voice. I hope you had a good time off.
Oh, it was a wonderful time off. There's only one thing I forgot to do, though. I did not get it done. And one of my New Year's resolutions is to make my grandmother Protsek's petitza recipe.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you guys had tried making that yet.
Yeah, we were doing other things, and we did have some folks over and things like that. So that kind of fell by the wayside. But, you know, it's wintertime, and it's a great time to bake.
Yeah.
And all petitza is for the uninitiated, and we of Slovenian and Polish heritage, we know this stuff. It's like a nut roll, right? That's rolled up.
Yeah.
That's a baked nut roll, and they're delicious as far as I'm concerned. Food of the gods.
Hey, we all could use a couple extra nuts.
Exactly. So what were you thinking, huh?
Well, the reason I called was two reasons. One of which, I wanted to thank you. I don't know how you guys came to the decision of bringing in MBR as part of your format. Those guys are great.
They're very funny.
What a great, the Limbaugh, you know, to replace Limbaugh is a big call. But they've done a great job.
You know, the thing is that, and I think they'd be the first to tell you, they never were about replacing Limbaugh, because Limbaugh can't be replaced. There's just no way. Limbaugh was a one of a kind. But they were definitely a different style of talk radio, more of a dialogue kind of thing with guys talking about these things and with various different perspectives, especially given the generational breakdown. You got the boomer, the Gen Xer, and the millennial, you know, all doing that together. And so it's interesting to hear the differences through the years from them. I enjoy them.
And the other reason I called, because, you know, you asked me, you guys, what Dr. Powers might have discussed, now I can't think of the name of the fort. It's Fort Lane.
Fort Lane.
I don't know if you've ever discussed Fort Lane, but that's a fascinating element of our history in this valley. Do you know about Fort Lane?
No, I don't. Where was Fort Lane? Could you help me out with that?
Fort Lane, if you get on Tolo Road, and it's on your way to Gold Hill, and you head towards the river, there's actually a site that was marked by the Daughters of the American Revolution. But I believe the Southern Oregon University has got a dig site there. But that was a fort that was built in 1855 through 1857.
Was that during the Indian War?
Exactly.
Period, right?
Its function was to protect pioneers and miners.
Yeah, I don't think that we've ever talked about that. And one of the reasons being is that we don't usually, because the segment, and even his book, was called Where Past Meets Present. And it's kind of like, it's not about something which is no longer there, but there has to be some connection to what's going on right now. But I suppose there could be. Really, you can talk about what it was like then and the changes that came within the various cultures here in Southern Oregon, you know, from that time.
Well, if you like history, Bill Sheridan, who was famous in the Civil War era, his first outpost of duty was at Fort Lane, out of West Point.
Oh. You know, there's another book which I've been reading right now. In fact, Bob Shan, You know Bob Shan. Bob, listener Bob calls all the time. We hear from him from Metro all the time. He lent me a copy of Captain Jack. Did you ever read that book?
Oh, I would love to read that.
Yeah, well, it's a first edition. I'm very careful with it. And, in fact, he asked me if I was done with it. I think he wants his first edition back. I'm about a third of the way through it. And it is such a fascinating read to look at the wars in the Indian territories here in Southern Oregon and Northern California at that time, how the Modocs and the Klamaths did not get along, and the balancing acts that the United States government with their forts and their outposts were doing, trying to keep peace in the push. And then, you know, you'll read these letters that talk about, well, you know, we want you to take care of the Indian problem peaceably if you can, forcefully if you must, right? You know, and you look at this, and yet you were talking about taking people and just force marching them 300 miles to the coast, you know, in some cases, right?
Yeah, a sad point in history if you were an Indian.
Yeah, yeah, it was really rough. But, you know, Captain Jack, of course, leader of the Modoc tribe, and they wanted nothing to do with the Klamaths. The Klamaths and the Modocs apparently hated each other, and I never really knew that part about it. And then they got sideways. Modocs, of course, got sideways with the United States government, and then they ended up going up into their cave dwellings up in the rocks, you know, above the... above the area.
Have you ever been? I took my kids when they were little to Captain Jack's last time. You ever been there?
No, I never have been. I want to now.
And to see what they defended themselves, the Fortress of the Rocks, it's incredible. It's just an incredible story.
Oh, I know. And, you know, you want to talk about, people that were putting it all on the line, whether you agreed with their cause or not. You know, people that would do stuff—they were made of something sterner, sterner stuff. I would dare say. You agree?
Oh, absolutely. And real quickly, if you got time, a great story regarding this. A friend of mine—he's retired now. He used to run the museum at Fort Klamath. One day, a guy and his wife came into the museum, and he had it was an era rifle, 1871 or two, Springfield. Anyway, shows him the rifle. He says, "What do you think?" He says, "Yeah, I'll give you $300." He's just jesting. And, I walked off mad. A month later, the wife walks in with the same rifle. "Are you still willing to buy this for $300? And he says, "Man, this gun is worth way more than $300. And says, "I just want to get rid of it." Turns out her husband died. Mm-hmm. Bottom line to this story, he does a search on it. That rifle went all the way back to Custer's last stand.
Oh, how much was it really worth out there on the market?
$400,000.
Whoa. Oh, my gosh.
Did you that one?
Yeah.
And he paid her the $300,000. I think he still has it.
You know, I think I probably would have sold it for the $400,000. I would have given her some of that, too. You know,
and I want to put it in gold.
Yeah, exactly. Happy New Year, Brad. Let me go to the next call. Like I said, it's open phones on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Hi, good morning. Who's this? Welcome.
Good morning, Bill. Michael Shaw here. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too, Michael. What's on your mind?
Well, one of the things that I have on my bucket list at the beginning of every year is to deal with my stockpile of ammo. Stock of what do I have, what do I need to rotate, and things like that. So it's just one of those reminders of people should look at where they're at with those sort of things. It's like I looked at mine over the weekend and realized that even though I have plenty of 5.56 and 9mm and 5.7 and such, and 45, I'm severely lacking in 12-gauge shotgun shells.
Oh, and you know, those are still relatively economical to buy, really.
Well, they are, but I mean, I've got a standard Ithaca 12 gauge. Actually, it's a police riot gun.
Yeah.
And that loaded with double odd buck is a great self defense weapon.
Well, you know where my challenge on ammo is, Michael, is rotating Because you know what will happen is that I'll buy fresh ammo, let's say, to go shooting. And I don't go shooting enough lately. I have to make a little more time for that in 2025. But, you know, I'll buy the stuff that I already have in boxes that I just picked up at, on the sales, you know, around here at the various stores, you know, that'll put stuff on sale. And yet I've got like PMC ammo that I bought from Coastal back when it was Big R, probably 15 years ago, sitting in ammo boxes there. You know, and I know it's still good. I've shot some of it, though. I have to start rotating that old stuff out, though, even though I know that ammo lasts for many, many years if you store it right, you know.
No, I agree. Rotating it out is always a big issue. So good reminder on that part. So I guess what we need to do is like what I do with the stuff I put in the freezer. I put a label with a date on it.
Yeah.
We need to date our ammo.
Maybe so. You know, shoot by and then put a date in, you know, that kind of thing. But and speaking of which, that ammo, to tell you, if I recall correctly, I think I bought the ammo at Big R, which is now Coastal. We know it as Coastal. I think it was six. I think it was I think it was 124 grain, 9mm for, I want to say, $6.99, I think, on a Black Friday sale. It was something like that. And it was like, man, having to love that, loving that kind of price, that's for sure. About half where it is right now.
Yeah, it's real hard to remember to do those basic things, but it, you know, I guess we need to put it on a calendar as a reminder.
Good point. Thanks for the reminder. Let me go to the next line here on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Good morning. Hi, who's this? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're on. Who's this?
Am I
on? Yes.
Oh, good morning. Bismarck.
Hey, Bismarck.
We're talking about that Fort Lane.
Yes.
If you're right there where the Tolo Tavern used to be, there's a contractor shop there. You go down that road that used to take you to the dam. On your left, there's actually a cemented pyramid of rocks, which is a marker for that fort that he was talking about. So people can actually drive up and see the marker, and there's a little brass plaque on it that tells you with a date and everything.
Yeah. I'm going to go look that up. I'm going to go look that up.
Well, looking it up on the computer.
Well, no, I meant like go there. I'm just going to go there.
Yes,
it's not that far.
It's just before you get to the dam. It's in between two homes, and it's like just like it's all open, and then right there where the pile is, it's all thicket, and then past it, it gets back into open again. But I was calling because he got my memory going. So my stepfather was in a metal detecting club back in the 1980s. So Fort Wagner, which is now at the bottom of where the Medford sewer, the water treatment plant is out there in the Tooville area.
Yeah.
So they had a big thing back then because my father was involved with the Historical Society. And they metal detected the entire area where the fort was. They found, you know, horseshoes, lots of Union buttons, belt buckles, all kinds of little metal artifacts. And somewhere they got put into the museum and then probably stored away somewhere. But where the Fort Wagner is at the bottom of those huge water holding tanks now. So every time you drive past the water treatment plant, that's where the other fort was.
Oh. Well, thank you for a little education on that. I didn't know that, Bismarck. Appreciate the call. You grab one more. That'll be news time. Then we're going to talk a little January 6th politics here. Where that's going. Hi, good morning. Who's this? Welcome.
This is Colonel Jay.
Hey, Colonel Jay. Welcome.
You were talking about ammo.
Yes.
They were talking about double buck for home defense and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, home defense and time of trouble is pheasant shot, high brass pheasant shot. You send the other guy home picking out pellets out of his back. That disables him. It's like two other guys that have to pick the pellets out of his back.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps them distracted. And anybody else that comes around, you put some more pellets in their back, and they just weaken their forces.
Yeah, I don't know.
What are you gonna do?
You know something? I've heard kind of that. I don't know if, I guess I want to make sure whatever ammo, if God forbid I had to fire it off in a home, would actually be, you know, a stopper.
No, it won't penetrate walls. That's why I said don't.
Yeah, but will pheasant shot actually, you know, will it stop an attacker, though, you think?
Yeah, no, Look, man, I've been shot before. I tell you what, it is extremely disturbing, and it doesn't feel good.
Yeah, nobody says, hey, volunteer to shoot me with a pheasant shot. I get that, okay? But I don't know. I don't know if I would advocate it necessarily for if the self-defense folks would. Well, you know, we could all have an opinion on that, all right? I appreciate the call. Thanks for making it. 6 after 8. We'll check news here in just a moment, too. KMED, KMED, HD1, Eagle Point, Medford, KBXG, Grants Pass. This is Bill Meyer, and the savings keep coming from Sky Park Insurance. Here's Kurt from Grants Pass.
The quote from my previous insurance.